Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davis. It's the 6th of March 2014, and today's interview is with Gregory Clark, Professor of Economics at the University of California. We discuss Professor Clark's new book titled The Sun Also Rises, Surnames and the History of Social Mobility. In the book, Professor Clark demonstrates that fate is determined by ancestry, and that social mobility rates are lower than conventionally estimated. They do not vary across societies and are resistant to social policies. I began the interview by asking Greg what prompted him to write the book, and in particular, what gave him the idea to look at surname data.
Well, interestingly, this idea actually came from a science writer at the New York Times, Nicholas Wade. And in an earlier book, I had talked about the upper classes in pre-industrial England taking over society demographically. And he said, well, couldn't you trace that out looking at surname? And I was saying, no, I don't think so, because British English surnames have pretty much equivalent status. And then it got me to thinking, well, they didn't have equivalent status when they were first created. That loss of status information is going to reflect the rate of social entropy, which is the rate of social mobility. And so the information content of surnames is actually going to be a fundamental indicator of social mobility in any society.
So where did you collect the data from for the book, and what were the main findings?
I actually went through things sequentially, making unexpected discovery after unexpected discovery. I started with England. We had information on people who were probated all the way back to 1400 from the Public Record Office. And what we quickly discovered was that social mobility rates were much slower than we were expecting. So that then led to looking at other data sources, like who attended Oxford and Cambridge, who was a criminal in the 19th century. And then, because people would then say, you know, when you find slow mobility rates, well, that's just Britain, you know, we knew it all along. Then it was interesting to look at Sweden as a society where we expected to find very high rates of social mobility, to look at pre-industrial Sweden, to look at the United States, where the myth of strong social mobility is very powerful in political life. And then some of the implications of this also led us to do things like look at India, where there's a different social structure, and ask, well, did that affect the rate of social mobility? China was a challenge, because there are only 4,000 surnames for 1.4 billion Chinese, but it's still the case that there are a few. We could only find 13 that were high status and relatively rare in the Qing imperial era, and that they're still overrepresented amongst elite groups in modern China, including the Communist Party. The main findings are that social mobility rates are everywhere very slow, and in fact, the hypothesis of the book is that the rate of social mobility is actually a constant. It's a physical constant similar to the constant of gravitation, and that it exerts powerful implications in society, and using that information, we can actually predict for a case like Britain, if we observe a social group at a certain level in 1800, where they'll be in 2000. It's that powerful in terms of predicting the movement of groups over long periods of time. And so, as I say, that's the main kind of startling finding of the book, is a surprisingly constancy to social mobility rates, constancy across different types of status, so education, wealth, income, even health. And also, it's the same at the top of the distribution as at the bottom of the distribution. There's a surprisingly simple structure to the social world, which, as I say, in economics, it's very rare to find any predictive formulas for societies, and this seems to be a case where there is one.
I know, that's why it's all the more surprising, because it's sort of counterintuitive in a way, because you wouldn't expect it to be the
yes,
case.
Absolutely. I mean, your intuition going into this, and the implications from previous studies of mobility, and I should explain that the book is not saying that these studies are incorrect, it's just that people have made, without thinking about it, incorrect inferences from these studies. Because typically, modern studies look at income inheritance from parent to child, and they've inferred from that, well, that's the generalized rate of social mobility. But what they haven't realized is that income is just one minor aspect of social status, and that these aspects of status can fluctuate a lot within families. But a more generalized measure of their position in society is actually going to evolve much more slowly. And when we look at those aspects, we see that, well, Sweden has high rates of social mobility measured in terms of income. Chile has low rates. Those must be fundamentally different societies. And it's also telling us that that's under the control of societies. It must be culturally determined. It must be determined by resources. It's a major problem that societies have to tackle. And the startling implication of this study is it's not under the control of society's social mobility. And further, it's not clear if low social mobility rates are a social problem. In fact, the book argues it's not actually a sign of social problem. It's a sign of relative social success, that social mobility rates are low.
So you suggest in the book that government intervention and social policies have little if no effect whatsoever on social mobility. Is that correct?
Absolutely. If Swedes cannot change that underlying rate of social mobility, then there's very little prospect that other societies such as the US or England or India, by changing their social policies now, are going to be able to do any better, given the length of time that Sweden attempted to intervene and the extensiveness of those interventions. There's generalized provision of education, of pre-education support, of family health in Sweden. It just hasn't fundamentally changed the rate of social mobility. And so that is one conclusion here, which is that investing huge amounts of resources in any society in trying to increase mobility is likely to be money not well spent.
How depressing.
Well, it depends what your interpretation is, right? And this is a crucial aspect, is that the first part of the book is just trying to measure rates of social mobility. But equally important, from my perspective, remember I'm an academic, not primarily a policymaker, is understanding what is the mechanism of inheritance. Is it resources? Is it cultural capital that families are passing on? Or is it genetics? And the book can't reach any firm conclusion on this. But one conclusion it can reach is that at least a majority of this inheritance is actually genetics. And the debate is about, is it 50% genetics or 100% genetics? Because there's clear evidence from a variety of studies, such as looking at adoption, looking at twins of various degrees of genetic relationship, looking at people who experience windfalls in terms of, one example we look at is the Georgia Lottery, the Cherokee Land Lottery of 1832, which gave the equivalent of more than 100,000 pounds to a variety of random males in Georgia. That had no impact on their children or their grandchildren's education or other measures of social status. And so we do a variety of studies here, and as I say, this startling implication is that overall, genetics is playing a very significant role in this inheritance. And if that's the case, then it may be a startling fact about social life that we can predict who's going to succeed socially and who will have struggled more. But it's not necessarily a sign of any failure in society. It may actually indicate we live in a much more meritocratic world than people have imagined.
Okay, so where does this leave then concepts such as free will, self-improvement, self-determination, etc.? Are you saying that the individual is completely disempowered?
No. The important thing I should emphasize in this study is that we find about half of people's lifetime outcomes are predictable if we knew enough about their lineage. And that's a generalized measure, not the individual aspects about whether you go into business or to a university or, a think tank. But half is still undetermined and random, right? Now, in the model of the book, though, that's randomness. That's not free will. But the important thing is it's still going to be the case that people achieve position in life or achieve success through hard work, through overcoming obstacles, through ability, through willingness to take risks, through finding a partner in life that will support them. And it's not going to be that things are handed to people on a silver tray. The thing is, though, it turns out we can predict with relatively high probability who will have those qualities. That's what's happening. But individual agency is not threatened in any way by this result. Things still happen because of individuals. But the problem is that we can say at birth to individuals, we think your chances of having that kind of set of characteristics that lead to success are actually pretty low.
Well, I'd hate someone to say that to me when I was born.
Right. Well, let me give you another example. This is actually after the study. It turns out one of the sets of data I have is everyone who's been to Oxford and Cambridge for most of the history of the universities. And I have a set of first names of people at Oxford and Cambridge in the last 5 years. And illustrating how much is predictable at birth, some first names that were given to children in 1990 predicted they had 1/80th of a chance of attending Oxford or Cambridge than other people who got a different surname, right? And so it's not that the surname is, I think, doing the job, but it's telling you how much just the choice of the parents of what name to give that child is powerfully indicative of what the life chances of that child are. And so in some sense, we knew that already.
Hold on, are you saying the name rather than the genetic lineage?
Well, the thing is, the name here is just, the choice of the name, the first name, is standing in for the parents' position in society, and the lineage of the parents as well, right? But I'm saying it's a startling fact that if you call a kid Jade as opposed to Elizabeth, you're establishing that that kid has 1/80th of the chance of Elizabeth's of getting into Oxford or Cambridge. And that's just an illustration that it's something we knew already, that at birth, a lot is predictable. And so all we're learning in these surname studies is, well, it also turns out that even your surname can also be a source of these types of predictions.
So what do you think then is the underlying cause of this sort of rigidity in social mobility? Genetic? Wealth? The class system? Or what is it?
The conclusion of the book is strongly that the lead contender, right? And it's not the horse that's won the race, but it's the one that's in the lead, as far as the data we have at present, is that genetics plays the overwhelming role. And so here's some of the studies we can do in the book that would rule out genetics, but don't. One of the predictions of a genetic explanation would be that a group that never outmarries, that marries only endogamously, would not experience this general pull towards the mean that we everywhere otherwise observe. And we do then, in cases like India, observe such groups. And in that case, we find that they do indeed tend to not regress towards the mean in the same way. So India has unusually low rates of social mobility. Or another example is the Copts of Egypt, who are a political minority, who don't have any political power and have not had that since the Arab invasions. They have remained the elite in Egypt for 1,500 years, which would not be observed in regular societies. They would have to regress to the mean. But that's a group which, again, does not marry outside the indicated group. And so, as I say, we can do various tests that show a consistency with this genetic explanation. Another implication of the book would be that success is not a cultural achievement, that any successful group will simply be a selection from a larger population, selected by some mechanism, such as the conversion of Copts to Islam. And when we look at the modern US, we see exactly that process operating. The most successful groups now are Egyptian Copts, Iranian Muslims, Indian Hindus, Maronite Christians from the Middle East, Black Africans, Ashkenazi Jews. And when you look at the histories of each of these cases, you can see that they actually have been drawn from some larger population elsewhere, but by the filter of U.S. policy created as an elite within the United States, and there's nothing that these groups have in common culturally. And so that's why I say that the book goes through and tries to think about the various tests of genetics as being the important element in this story, and it doesn't prove the case, but it leaves it as a surprisingly strong contender.
So you mentioned then sort of movement towards a mean.
Right.
So does that mean that the higher social levels, if you like, move down towards an average and the lower ones do over time? And
yes.
If so, how long?
It depends how far you are away from the mean, right? Mm. And we actually find very regular effects that if you're moderately away from the mean, then 5 generations will get you back. But if you're some super elite group in England, it'll take sometimes 10 to 20 generations for you to become completely average again. One of the things I should emphasize is that people should take heart from this fact. The upper groups we observe in any society cannot defend their position. All elites will have their time now, but are bound to be replaced. And the lowest group in any society are on their way up. And that's actually, as I say, something that's very hard under explanations that are based on resources or culture to understand why elites can't defend themselves. The bankers in the city have all the assets, all the access to the best schools, but their children are headed downwards. And so I actually draw comfort from that fact about society, not the kind of pessimism that other people exist. It turns out as an interesting feature that whenever we observe a group, if they're above the mean, they're headed downwards, right? But we also, from this simple model, we can predict the prehistory of groups, and it turns out there's a symmetrical period of rise, and we can actually observe that in the data, that if we observe the elite of 1800 will see a 200-year period as they gradually moved away from the mean, and then this 200-year period as they return.
That's extraordinary. So what do you think this all means, Greg, in terms of political and social ideals such as income distribution, equal rights, equality of opportunity, etc., if social mobility, status and success are to an extent predetermined, as you say? What's the value in trying to escape from that, or even, you know, what's the value in trying to help to try lift people out of poverty and social exclusion, etc.?
I think it's very important to stress the difference between social mobility and inequality, and often these two things are conflated. And so the interpretation I take, and as I say, this is moving beyond description and kind of science into philosophy and ethics, is that if we do indeed live in a world where much is predetermined, it's a strong argument for narrowing the inequalities in our society. If we know who, for the next few generations, who's likely to be at the top and who's likely to be at the bottom, then it's a strong argument for saying, let's not make the rewards from being at the top too high and the costs of being at the bottom too low. Because it turns out, it doesn't seem to be there's any sign that you need huge incentives in order to get these families to stay at the top. Whatever the social structure is, they're going to be there. And in that case, we can be much more liberal in terms of, let's help the people at the bottom. And understanding much more that this was not, you woke up, you decided, I'm not going to try in life, right? That's not the nature of the social system. Understanding that, I think, gives us more sympathy with people at various ranks in society. And so I actually take this as an endorsement of a Nordic-style society and as a rejection of the American model of society, which really does depend on the idea of mobility and individual responsibility.
That's interesting. So you're branching into the sort of philosophical elements here, and I guess what your research doesn't comment on is the extent to which self-consciousness or cultivating one's mind and personal sense of values, etc., that's something that fortunately doesn't fall into the idea of predetermination.
Right.
And I guess there's hope in all of us there, because it's the values that we live by will determine the future of the human race, right?
This, I agree that this raises troubling concerns, because social status seems such a broad aspect of people's lives, right, that it seems hard to think, could that be determined at the molecular level, right? What your overall rank, what your overall social competence is. And so I think we have to avoid getting into the trap of saying if something is genetically determined or predictable, that somehow eliminates human agency and eliminates the role of people in deciding what type of life they're going to make. And, I mean, one of the other troubling things about these studies is when you start thinking about social mobility is there is this implication there are winners and there are losers in the social world. And it's really hard to think of, you know, but that is how we think of society. And I think what we also then have to say is, given our knowledge of this, we have to understand that there are many other aspects of people that make them valuable. There are connections of friendship, of love, of support.
Acts of kindness
and
goodwill.
Acts of kindness and goodwill. And that's what makes a rich and rewarding society. And that any study like this that's fixates on social success is going to appear to undermine those values in society, and those are the values that make us this what we are, and that we in the end have to return to.
That's very nice. So finally, Greg, what's your main conclusion or principal insight from this research that could be of help in either stimulating further research or would be helpful for policymakers, if at all?
People are very unwilling or unable to learn the lesson that we can remake technology, we can split atoms. It's very hard to re-engineer the social world, and we have to have much more modest aims in this regard. There are models, though, of what can be achieved, but what is depressing to me is to hear people return again and again to the idea that something can be done, which has never been achieved before in human societies. And so I think one of the things that this has to teach us is more of a sense of modesty, and a sense that we maybe have to more learn how to live within the world, the structures that we're foisted with, and not think that we can rebuild the world tomorrow.
Gregory Clark, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
That was great. Thank you very much.